Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 656. Today's episode is brought to you by Crunchyroll, the place to stream anime online. If you're a fan of anime and you're a fan of the internet, then you absolutely want to go straight to crunchyroll.com/nerdist, since you're going to get 30 days of anime in HD quality, 1080p with no ads. That is a premium account free for a month. They have a gigantic collection. Some shows are available just 1 hour after they air in Japan. That is the level of dedication we're talking about here with Crunchyroll. It is by anime fans for anime fans. So go to crunchyroll.com/nerdist. Sign up for a 30-day free trial of Crunchyroll Premium and enjoy your anime. Let's go to the Nerdist Community Cork Board. First one, by the way, if you want to get your event potentially mentioned on a Nerdist podcast, email us at events@nerdist.com. WonderCon is this weekend. That is April 3rd, 4th, and 5th. Nerdist will be present. We have a bunch of panels there. We have a booth set up with our pals at Geek & Sundry. And so we'll all be there at various times. And come by, stop by the booth. We'll have some fun activities and stuff for you to look at. And then I'll be hosting the overall Nerdist panel in the arena on Sunday, I believe at 11 a.m. So a bunch of folks from Nerdist will be there. We'll have some announcements. We'll show some footage of stuff, answer some comments, and generally have a delightful WonderCon time as we mentally prepare for San Diego Comic-Con, which is coming down the pipeline. It's going to be here before you know it. And we will be doing shows there, so we'll be able to announce those soon. But here is what you guys are up to out in the world. Denver comedian Ben Roy, a friend of ours, a friend of mine, he's an amazing comedian. Denver has an incredible comedy scene. He's part of the Grolix with Adam Caton Holland and Andrew Overdahl. He is in a punk band called Spells. So find out all about their music at spellsrules.bandcamp.com. Also, this was from Nerdist listener Chad David. I have some friends who own the Ridiculous Puppet Company in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Every week they do a comedy vlog with their main character, Felton. It's a lot of sci-fi movie humor and very weird. So check out their YouTube channel, youtube.com/ridiculouspuppetco. As in Ridiculous Puppet Company. And Indie PopCon is coming to Indianapolis Convention Center June 26th through 28th. Go to Indie PopCon for more details. And again, events@nerdist.com. This episode is Ben Gibbard, who is basically Death Cab for Cutie, a band that I've been a fan of for over a decade, and also The Postal Service, another band that I've been a fan of for over a decade. Death Cab has a new album out called Kintsugi. It is out Tuesday, March 31st. And Ben's on tour with Death Cab, so info and tour dates can be found at deathcabforcutie.com. We recorded this podcast at SIR in Hollywood, so which is a huge recording / rehearsal facility that is very cool to us. And so Ben played a song, which was fantastic, considering that he's just getting over a fractured wrist. He still played and sang. But Ben's super funny and very cool, and I'm going to say a new pal of mine. Like, we kind of became buds. So, the podcast, bringing people together. This podcast, by the way, also brought to you by Stamps.com. Stamps.com is going to make your life better and easier because you have to mail things. We still have to snail mail things, all right? Until we can perfect matter transporters, until we can email solid objects, then you're going to have to use the Postal Service, Ben Gibbard. Oh, it almost plays out too well. Stamps.com will give you all of the service of any post office right from your desk. Blink, 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 blink. Buy an official print. Buy and print out official U.S. postage for any letter package using your computer or printer. Then you just hand it to your mail carrier. Very easy. Blah, 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 blah. I'm going to stop doing that now. I apologize. You probably fast-forwarded through that little blurb. Unlike the post office, Stamps.com is open 24/7 with no lines. So get your mailing and your shipping done whenever it is convenient for you, friend. Right now, use the promo code NERDIST for the special offer. No risk trial. $110 bonus offer, including a digital scale and up to $55 of free postage. Go to Stamps.com before you do anything else. Click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in NERDIST. That is Stamps.com. Enter the promo code NERDIST. And now, here's the Nerdist Podcast number 656 with the fantastic Ben Gibbard.
Now entering Nerdist.com. We had to change it, right?
Chris Cornell's very litigious. Yeah.
Everything's changed just enough.
There was threats of lawsuits, and we had a back
on. Black hole moon. Won't you coom?
So you still have black and hole in there. You got to change it all up.
You can't do it the same. Yeah. Welcome. Is your hand okay, or is that just to keep it protected?
My hand is healing, but it's I broke it about 6 weeks ago, so I'm in the last week of kind of wearing the splint around strangers so they don't try to.
So as a musician, when you break your hand, you're like, well, this is great. I mean, right. I get to rest. I don't have to work. It's all positive.
I can't do the thing. I can't do my work.
I can't do the thing that pays the bills that people expect me to do.
I mean, honestly, the timing could have been worse. This could have happened a week ago. And honestly, it happened at a time which was not obviously advantageous to working and enjoying life. But at the same time, there's enough time for it to heal before we have to play actual shows and like that.
Well, it's never fun to break a hand.
No, it's never fun. Yeah. There's never a good time for it. But if there has to be a time for it, it's best to happen not before a world tour.
Especially when you're saving those children from that speeding bus. Then you're a true hero.
Thank you. Well, you guys clearly saw the news report.
Yeah. We saw the...
You need to go into it, really.
Yeah. It's not until you injure yourself in some horrible way in a moment that you realize how incredibly fragile you are, or how hard you swing your legs when you're walking, when you smack your foot into something. You're like, wow, at any moment, I am a second away from crippling myself to live my life.
Yeah, and your bodies are extremely fragile, I found out. They're not as strong as you think they are.
Well, you get confused sometimes because it goes the other way too, where you like you fall or you hit something and you go, that didn't hurt one bit. I'm a fucking superhero. I'm just like Bruce Willis and Unbreakable.
No, we're like iPhones. Like you could drop two times and then one time drop not so bad and then we just shatter.
That's exactly it. Yeah,
so it really is just about catching us on the right.
And I feel the opportunities that I've not taken, which I should have throughout this entire broken hand situation, is that lying to strangers about how it happened.
Yeah.
I haven't taken up any of the opportunities to ask, you know, you're on a plane or something like that, and somebody's like, oh my God, what happened to your hand?
Yeah.
And I immediately launch into the story of exactly how it happened instead of all of the things I could tell them that they're never going to know. Just for my own amusement. I mean, the same thing. Oh, yeah, these kids were out running, playing in the street, and this runaway bus came along, and I wasn't meaning to be a hero. I was playing a festival, so I
crowd surfed, I ran across all the hands of the people and leapt into the road and saved these kids. Mm-hmm. But finished the set at the same time.
You know, really, it's the crowd that are the real heroes for lifting me up.
Yeah, it was a... Never.
I do it for them. They did it for me.
What is the real story?
I was running a trail race on Orcas Island up in the San Juan Islands outside of, I guess, northwest area.
Yeah.
And I was just crossing this footbridge. It was wet and rainy as it is in the northwest. And just hit it and just went down like a ton of bricks. Just kind of total banana peel style, but not as funny.
Yeah.
And went down and just shattered the wrist. The bones were all... Clearly not where they were supposed to be. Nothing wrong with the skin.
Oh, no. Oh,
but,
no.
I mean, you know, got some surgery. And I'm very nonchalant about it now. I was pretty devastated when it happened. But it's been 6 weeks and, you know.
Do you think it would have been worse if it was your left hand?
Without a doubt. Yeah. Because I can't, you know, obviously, I can't move it at all with a splint. But, you know, I only have about maybe an inch worth of movement right and left. And when you're playing guitar, you have to have quite a bit.
You can just do this in a weird – you can just strum up and down.
Or I could do like the Bill Wyman thing and turn the guitar.
Yeah, you got to get a V, flying V, so
vertically,
and rest it on your leg straight up like that.
Yeah, maybe proper guitar form is – I could maybe
like the old Les Paul style.
Maybe I've been doing it wrong the whole time. Yeah.
Maybe just rubber cement a pick into the cast and then just do this really hard.
Just look like a guy from Rock of Fire Explosion. You'll just kind of look like
just as awkward as possible. Yeah. Or like strum with your knee. Like there's so many weird things you could do.
I really miss some clearly some great opportunities.
It's a lot of things to think about, Ben.
Still got a lot of time. A lot of time to do all that.
Yeah, just re-break it.
What I'm saying is let Jonah and I be part of your creative team. We're going to come up with ways, pyrotechnic ways, weird guitar strumming ways that are really going to take the band to the next level.
What about some pyrotechnic shooting out of the splint?
I like it.
It's crazy you say that. Idea number four. Pyro splint techniques. Was on the list of things.
It was, and it was written down like that a few times.
Crossed out. No, that's not how you spell that. I was trying to find the right portmanteau.
That's not how you spell that made up word.
Damn it, I'm no good at this. I quit, Jonah.
No, this is all still written down. You're saying I quit. I say please don't.
So your tour, you're starting in, your tour starts pretty, like, in a couple days, right? You're starting in Mesa.
Well, we have like a one-off show in Mesa, and then we start the tour going from city to city on April 27th, I guess, in Kansas
City. This is the first tour in a long time, right?
Yeah, I mean, I guess like the last time we were on tour proper was summer 2012, so I guess that's a long time in rock,
you know,
rock and roll.
Yeah. 2012, I think of like, oh, 2012. Oh, no, that was 3 years ago. God damn it.
Well, I think it's just
time is moving very fast. Time is slipping away.
And, when people say, like, it's been 4 years since your last record, isn't that a long time? Like, actually, not really. It feels like it was just yesterday we were doing this whole thing in the last one. So
Mosmouse, after, was it 7-8 years, put out an album?
Yeah.
Yeah. They didn't, and like, I was like, I was reading some interview with Isaac, and he was like, I didn't realize it was that long.
I don't know Isaac hardly at all, but that would not surprise me.
You don't see him in the Northwest Indie Rock picnics?
Every year we get together for our Children of Built to Spill picnic, and we all talk about how much Doug has influenced us all.
Yeah. Tree People Memorial Park. That's exactly right.
I'm really impressed with that reference.
A little deep cut there.
Yeah, going deeper than I would. I mean, not to
sell you short. Look at me.
But I didn't know that people knew the Tree People outside of this very small, you know, area of the country. I wasn't aware they were.
Yeah, well, I guess, you know, just like any kind of kid that's into punk or indie rock, like, you know, you dive in and go back.
Right.
You know, because I heard Built to Spill way before I ever heard Tree People, but it was just one of those things where it's like, you know, you're like, yeah, you find, you're like, oh, where'd they come from? Then you go and do that stuff.
Sure, sure, yeah.
But yeah, pretty good stuff.
I mean, I am amazed. Do you have time to listen to things anymore, or are you too busy making your own stuff?
Like, listen to music?
Yeah, I mean, it's just Jonah always surprises me because he sees every movie, watches every television show, hears every album. I'm like, where do you get the time to do these things?
I do it like, so Tuesdays, I'll get on my, you know, the RDO app, and I'll look and see what's new. Like, you know, that's a release day. So I kind of shuffle through all the stuff that looks interesting to me. And then that's when I get my day start. But I'm kind of doing that as I do other stuff.
Do you listen to other stuff while you're writing and recording, or do you?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Oh, you do.
Yeah. I mean, I like, my kind of music intake time tends to be in the morning. You know, I kind of put on records and drink coffee and kind of just, and I do a similar thing. You know, on Tuesday, I scroll through new records and kind of see if anything's kind of moving me, and sometimes I do, most times I don't. But yeah, I mean, I love music. I love listening to music. I swore to never become one of those people who says it's just not as good as it used to be when I was young. I mean, that's just such a bullshit cop out kind of.
That's just people that didn't keep up.
Exactly,
because that's the only way they know how to defend the fact that they stopped listening. Because stuff is still just as good as it ever was. It's just not, they're like, it's almost nostalgia is ruining new music for them.
You know what it is, too, is that the older you get, the more effort it requires to be surprised by things. Like, you have to find ways in when you're young and you haven't heard a lot. Everything to you is like, oh, I can't believe someone did this.
Oh, no, I remember, I just recently, I was like hanging out with a friend of a friend who was 22, and they were talking about what they were listening to, and everything they said they were listening to was the, quote unquote, the greatest thing I've ever heard. This is the best. And yeah, when you're young and you haven't heard a lot of music, naturally more things are going to blow your mind. You know, there's a frequency of getting your mind blown that's much higher when you're that age than when you're, I'm 38. When you're 38, it's like, yeah, I get my mind blown by stuff a lot less frequently than I did when I was that age. But that's not because music is worse. It's because I've just heard a lot of music and am, you know, adjusting my expectations as to what the music is going to do to me in a 38-year-old man's body.
Right.
Which is just, unfortunately, you know, it doesn't feel the same.
No. But it is nice to be surprised. It is nice to like find something and to know what they're up to, but still appreciate like, you know, there's like lots of bands that I hear that they sound like all the bands I listened to when I was in high school, but there's just something different enough to where I go, yeah. I know what they're doing and I like what they're doing with it and I appreciate it. And like I think covered one of their songs, right?
Yeah. I mean, this band Always from kind of Toronto area. I believe it's Toronto.
It's one of my favorite records of last year.
They're wonderful. And they're this kind of jangly pop group, and they scratch the Teenage Fan Club itch that I have, which is Teenage Fan Club is my favorite band of all time. And I don't listen to them and go like, oh, these guys are trying to sound like Teenage Fan Club. It's like, I go, oh my God, these guys sound kind of like Teenage Fan Club. And I love that band.
Yeah.
And I love this, you know, I think that she is such a phenomenal songwriter and that, you know, they just sound so great and really just exciting and interesting. And
the high road, Ben, taking the high road approach, not being bitter old man. And going, oh, I can appreciate things.
I mean, but I can. It's like, you know, I mean, there's a song that I covered of theirs called Archie Marry Me that is, I don't know how old these.
That's their fucking jam.
I know that song.
Yeah, you know that song?
Yeah, they've been playing it on
XMU plays
XMU.
It a bunch,
yeah. They're playing on XMU.
It's a wonderful song, and it's the kind of song that I'm jealous that I didn't write when I was that age, which I'm assuming is early 20s-ish kind of age. It's just such a beautiful song about, you know, not, you know, wanting kind of the stability of marriage or a long-term relationship, but shunning all of the tropes and kind of traditions that, you know, your parents' generation kind of, you know, has kind of leveled on you, so to speak, or something like that. But
yeah,
great song. Yeah.
It is a good song. I didn't know what it was. And I try not to Shazam while I'm driving. You know, some people go, well, at least I'm not texting. Like, yes, but interacting with your device is still interacting with your device. So I try not to Shazam while I'm driving. And I had no idea who did that song, but I've been hearing it a ton.
Like, if something's on, you know, Sirius or something like that, I'll take a picture of the screen just to remember to go back to it later.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Yeah. So, like, I'll go back and be like, oh, yeah, I have to check these out because it piqued my interest.
Now, when you're covering a song, because sometimes I'll hear someone cover a song and they cover it exactly, even going back, so, like, the the Echo and the Bunnymen covered People Are Strange, and of course it was on the
Lost Boy soundtrack.
Mm-hmm. But they covered it exactly like The Doors. And even that long ago, I was like, why would you cover this? Like, you're just doing karaoke at that point. Like, what responsibility do you think you have to find some new angle on something without being self-indulgent, but then you know, like, elevating the song in some new direction?
You know, I don't know. I suppose that, well, first off, to the Echo and the Bunnymen cover, I would say that the issue number one that I have with that is just covering The Doors in the first place. Number one, that's kind of that.
I take issue with
The Doors in general as a band.
Me too. I get shit for it all the time.
Yeah, I'm not. I think they're the only. I mean, look, people love them. That's fine. That's great. But for me personally, they're the only kind of classic rock band that I really do not like.
No, I don't like The Doors either.
They're the worst. They would make a good song and then say, well, what if this was 10 minutes? They were so shitty. I used to work in Venice Beach and I grew to hate them even more so because of all the people that would just go, yeah, Morrison, man. I go, yeah, drunk
and to,
with the
and
notebook.
To, and to that I say, ride the snake.
Yeah.
Right. To the lake. The snake is long.
I mean, if some guy, like if you were at a poetry slam, if you were like in a coffee house and there was a poetry slam and some guy was like, and then it walked on down the hall, you'd be like, we have to get out of here. This is really not good.
Yeah, they're the Smash Mouth of their time.
Take a drink.
Yeah. Well, there was even, what was the, Bruce McCullough had that bit, the Kids in the Hall bit where he's talking about like Doors fan.
Yeah.
Making fun of The Doors and Doors fans and stuff like that. They're just not good. I don't know why they got – you never know what history is going to do to a band because like Smash Mouth, they made a lot of money. And there's a lot of people that if you ask them, it's like, yeah, that's their band. And so, you know, in 30 years, are people going to be going, you know, the classics like Smash Mouth and Korn and, you know, like
– I mean, but you know, that's – I mean, I have no issue with either of those bands as much as I do The Doors. But I will say that like, you know – what I find interesting is that, you know, I think across all genres, there are people who are acting as tastemakers who are trying to tell us like, this is the most important thing right now. You will be listening to this. This is the most important band of this second. And they, you know, people might only so many people might get it and listen to it, but you know, this band is going to really do something and be important. And more times than not, the reality of the situation is that the bands that are the most popular become the bands that people are talking about later as some kind of canonized act, whether or not they were the best acts of their time. Yeah. Does that make sense?
Yeah. But does that happen more now that things have become a little more democratized in terms of how people can get music, that it's not just filtering through, you know, a handful of channels? Because when I worked at K-Rock in the 90s, it was basically whatever Kevin Weatherly said, like, this song's going to be a hit, became a hit because they played it on K-Rock, you know? But now it doesn't have to follow the same rules anymore. So people are finding music they wouldn't have found otherwise.
Well, and I think that's fantastic. I mean, I feel like I've maybe told the story a couple times, but it's because it made such a huge impression on me. I remember being at an Animal Collective show here in Los Angeles, maybe 2009, 2010. And I'm sitting there watching the show. I knew the sound guy was a buddy of mine. And Lou Barlow from Sebado is also there because he was friends with the sound guy. And we kind of know each other a little bit. So we're sitting there talking. We're watching the show. It's at the Will Turn. It's fucking sold out. And I turned to Lou and I'm like, this is fucking weird, right? This band is really strange. I love this band.
They're really weird.
Really weird. And there are 2,400 people going bonkers. And this wouldn't have been possible 10 years ago. People would not have found out about this band if they were relegated to finding out about them via your local alternative radio station, if you were in the proximity of a college radio station that would be playing them. And I think it just goes to show that, like, if you give people myriad options, and, you know, people are going to gravitate towards the best stuff usually, you know, and the most interesting and challenging stuff. At least enough people will that, you know, a weird ass band like the Animal Collective is playing the Wiltern.
Yeah,
and it's sold
20 years
out.
Before they would have been Can.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, exactly.
Would have been that, like, weird band that, like, you know, like the guys that listen to Zappa get into.
Does Death Cab have a home on radio now? Like, it feels like the alternative stations are in this sort of weird place where some of them have gone, like, classic alternative,
which is a strange phenomenon.
Really,
right?
Is a strange college radio on SiriusXM.
Well, not even classic college radio. It's like pop music. Pop alternative music from the 90s, like the Green Day era.
Yes. Yeah,
so
yeah.
Not even like, you know, not even like, you know, Live's first album or old REM, you know, like it's Green Day and early Fiona Apple all that stuff. It's like they become all classic rock stations now.
Yeah, that's a really strange phenomenon. The music that, I mean, I'm 38, as I said, and, you know, the music in the early 90s that was kind of ubiquitous amongst teenage kids into like punk and indie alternative, whatever it was, you know, called at the time, that music now would be canonized as like, oh man, here comes Man at the Box at you for like the 10th time today.
Coming up on the weekend.
And that's a fucking great song. I really like that band, but it's like, it's crazy how some of this material that I grew up with as a teenager now is just like, you just can't almost get away from it because stations like that are just continuing to kind of just like, well, we know they like this, so let's just play this for them again.
I think you could kill a Man in the Box cover.
You think so?
I do, because it's actually like when you take out all the loud parts of the song.
You know what band I'm in, right?
I do. But I think when you take all the loud parts out of Man in a Box, it actually can be like there's like a nice melody under there somewhere that I think
if I was going to go after any Alice in Chains song, I think it would probably be The Rooster.
Yeah.
Yes.
The Rooster.
Oh.
Because it has those killer harmonies in the chorus.
Speaking of good covers, Jay Mascis's version of Mazzy Star's Fade Into You. Now, that's like pretty – he does it just like Mazzy Star did, but it's somehow just weird and even sadder somehow with Jay Mascis singing it. Have you heard it at all?
I haven't, but I'm hearing it in my mind right now, and I'm really enjoying it.
Yeah. But you have to be very careful with covers, though, because you kind of don't – I mean, it's fun to do covers, but you don't necessarily want a cover to blow up too big, right? Because then –
Alien Ant Farm effect.
Well, here's what you don't want to do, which is what I've done.
How dare you?
Maybe I guess it'd be about maybe 14 years ago. I was really obsessed, like legitimately obsessed with Avril Lavigne's Complicated.
Uh-huh.
I was legit, and it was before Avril Lavigne was Avril Lavigne, so to speak. Not to say that it was like in her like early indie period or anything like that, but it was just like it was a song on the radio, and I'd kind of hear it, and I'd be like, man, that song's great. What a great hook and the chorus. So I played it at an acoustic show, like kind of like tongue in cheek, but like I really liked it. You know, like I was kind of embarrassed about how much I liked it. So I kind of made jokes about it. But in actuality, I was playing it because I loved it. And from that day on, I've been asked to play that song by people who know that I covered it, and like it's become a weird little when I play solo shows that somebody will yell it, and it's I can't get away from it.
Well, that's a perfect place to say, ladies and gentlemen, here's Ben Gibbard playing Complicated.
Well, that happened to Ryan Adams when he did that Oasis cover. When he did what was the song he covered? Not Champagne Supernova, but Don't Look Back in Anger. He just like he did part of it at a show. Someone just happened to tape it, put it online, and he just did like a line from it. And people like, and then he went to his regular song. But he ended up having to cover it because people found the video and wanted him to play the entire
song.
So
that's an interesting question: is how much do you own your set when you're playing? You know, like you have a relationship with your audience; you want them to be happy. You're mm-hmm. there because they are supporting you. Mm-hmm. So where do you kind of say, well, I'm going to do this for me versus, all right, well, I'll make a compromise and I'll play some stuff that maybe I wouldn't have normally, but if you guys want to hear it, fine.
I mean, you know, I'm not going to play Complicated again. That's the line for me. But I really believe that when you're doing when you're making a record and writing songs, like that's kind of the time to be an artist, you know, to kind of make the permanent record of the thing how you want it to be. But I've always been perplexed by bands that go out and just refuse to play their hits,
right.
Refuse to play the songs people know. And it's kind of like, hey, man, the reason there's 5,000 people here is because they want to hear that song
right.
that got them into you. And it's going to take 4 minutes of your time.
Yeah.
And you can go on to playing whatever spacey, like jam rock bullshit you mm-hmm. want to play, but just play the hit and then you can move on. And I've had some friends who've kind of really been artists about the whole thing. It's like, no, man, we're not doing that. It's like, just fucking do it. Like, it takes no time, and that means they'll come back next time. Yeah, I really feel like when you're playing shows, you're there to be a performer. You're there to entertain people.
And you run into those people in like 5 years, and there aren't people showing up to their shows, and they're like, fuck, I probably should have played that song that I wanted to. When I saw Beck, he at the Orpheum downtown, he did like 6 songs from the new thing that he was working mm-hmm. on, and he was like, sit through these songs and then I'll play all the hits.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what happened. Then totally. He played every fucking hit with the same amount of energy that he played it before.
I've seen two very different types of Built to Spill shows. The first time I saw him, it was like maybe 4 songs, hour and a half show, mostly jamming. And I was devastated. And I was just like, I just never got into seeing things drawn out that much, you know, reason I don't like the Doors. But then the next time I saw him, they just like blaze through every song I ever wanted them to play. And like now I'll just go and see them like every time they come into town.
Oh man, I saw them in January and they did the second set. They did the like, we are going to play all the hits. I mean, they have a new record that's coming out that I've heard and it's great.
Yeah, the single's great.
Yeah, but they didn't play anything off that at the time. They're like, look, we're just going to go out and play all the hits. And people were fucking stoked.
Yeah.
And it was one of those moments where as a fan, a longtime fan, it made me even more excited about the next record, which I had not heard at that point, because I'm like, oh man, this band's been around forever. They're one of my favorite bands. They're integral in why we are who we are, I think very obviously to some people. And this is why this band's still important. You know, it's like, this is why they're important, because they have all these songs that have stood the test of time, at least for the last 20 plus years. And you know, there's 1,200 people here who are really getting psyched. And they're all getting psyched for the next record now, I feel like, because they're going to be back again later, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
Do you think it's important to play the song exactly the way people expect? Or do you, like, what's the balance between mixing it up or trying it a new way or, you know?
I saw Billy Bragg a number of years ago, who's one of my favorites. And I don't know if you guys know that song, The Great Leap Forward. It's on Workers' Playtime. It's the last song on the record, and it's kind of very political song about what was happening in the world at that time. And you know, lyrics are great. It's really fantastic. And he had rewritten the lyrics to be about the current time. It was now all about, I guess it was 2002, 2003 when I saw him. And I remember leaving the show being kind of bummed that he changed the lyrics to reflect our modern era at the time, rather than just singing the song the way it was written. I think that bummed me out. I mean, the show was great. It wasn't like I didn't leave, you know, wanting my money back. Or anything
was it
like that,
because you were singing along and then you started singing other words and then you felt embarrassed?
It may have been Camelot. No, it's not Camelot.
He's saying the wrong words.
George Bush is in the song? George Bush isn't in the song, I don't think.
Same thing happened to me with Elton John at Princess Di's funeral. I'm like, goodbye, Norma. Shit, that's not what he's doing now. I thought you would have liked that joke.
I do like that joke.
This is an interesting question for me, is when you do something like Postal Service, which is a departure from what you do as Death Cab, and then you're doing a Death Cab show, where people like, play a Postal Service song, and you're like, well, this isn't that show.
That happened a lot when the Postal Service, we got back together, or I guess we never really were not together, but we went out and did some shows in 2013, and up until that point, there was inevitably every night, maybe not every night, but frequently enough, somebody yelling out like, Such Great Heights, play this and that. And, you know, you don't want to stop the momentum of the show to give somebody, to take somebody to school about why that's not going to happen.
Okay, fine. Bloop, bloop, bleep, bloop, bleep, bloop. Okay, you happy? Exactly. Are you happy?
But it was also, but, you know, in my mind, I'd think like, what in the world makes you think that we're just going to stop this like carefully curated set to play a song by another band?
Yeah. Well, people don't see it that way. And I think a lot of times it's very empowering for people to feel like I'm going to marionette the band and like having their request. I mean, it's like, you know, like having their request met in real time live is very empowering for someone.
Yeah. I mean, but I don't think that there has to be a band that did that years ago that like just stopped the set and played whatever somebody yelled, that kind of set the precedent.
Good idea.
Set the precedent. The loge is right. We're fools.
We are playing Freebird tonight. It's like that must have happened at one point, and then you know, it just kind of word got out that if you just yell a song at a band, they will play it. They will drop everything and play it for you.
Because it's basically like a spam email. Like they wouldn't send them out if it didn't work some of the time.
Right, exactly. There's some suckers out there.
All bands need to stand together. Solidarity. Yeah. Never take over. The same thing must happen with Lou Barlow with like Folk Implosion, I'm sure.
Oh, totally.
Oh, that's a good point.
Or
people,
or, you know, it's like total side thing. And then all of a sudden,
Natural One. Play Natural One.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
But look, it's a good problem to have. I can't fucking believe that my life has been as such where like I've had two separate things that I've done that have been in the world and that people care about that much that they would yell Such Great Heights at me at a Death Cab show. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like I joke about it and being annoyed by it, but the reality is like, look, it's a good problem to have. I feel so fortunate that this is that I was even able to do it once, let alone twice. So.
Was there an ultimate lesson that you took away from Postal Service, which I assume was just like, oh, let's just make this because it's a fun, weird thing to do. And then watching that, that must have...
It was crazy how big it got.
I mean, when I first heard it, I must have listened to it like 5 times in a day the first time.
Yeah, that was like one... We sold so many of those. I was still working at a record store at the time, and it was just nonstop. And every, like, you know, one of those things that just happens, like... Someone said it was the good thing, and then all different types of people were coming and asking for that record. It was really...
You know, it was a weird phenomenon to be peripherally involved with because we weren't playing shows. We weren't – there was no way to be in front of these people that were buying the records. So, you know, we would just get numbers from Sub Pop Records every 6 months of like, you know, sold another 100,000. We're up around 600,000 now. And you're like – and it was almost like, what is going on? It was – it almost felt as if I couldn't – it was something – not something we could take credit for. You know, we couldn't just sit back and be like, wow, we really did it, didn't we, guys? Or actually, we really did this, didn't we, guy?
Well, I don't know if a lot of people had this experience, but for me, not only were the songs wonderful, but because of the specific types of sound pads that were used, the first thing I thought of was like Super Mario. Like, it took me back to my childhood, but in a grown-up way. Rather than just going, here's that 8-bit sound, you know, like no one had really, at least I hadn't heard it yet. No one had really mined that yet and done something new and original with it. So it was part of my childhood, but also like felt like the contemporary and then also part of the future as well.
Yeah, well, it was like, you know, Ditell had a couple records out by then, right? Mm-hmm.
I think so. But well, like Figurine, he was doing this thing called Figurine too at the time.
But there weren't like, you know, like, which is like one of your strongest suits, is like, you know, there was no like hooks in this like, you know, glitchy pop music. And like, I think it was just like that just thing that came together that just made it blow up for everybody.
Well, it seemed like electronic music to that point had gotten really academic.
Yeah.
It had gotten really... it was a music for connoisseurs of that music, and I don't particularly see the Postal Service record as something really that that original, because so much of it is kind of mining the songs that I grew up with as a kid listening to, like, you know, the electro pop new wave stuff in the early 80s. I mean, that's kind of where a lot of that record comes from. But I think I realized only after the fact that a lot of kids who got into that record had no context for it. Yeah. It was just like, oh my God, this is such a new and exciting sound. It's like, well, yeah, the song kind of sounds like the Human League. I mean, I feel almost a little embarrassed about how much it sounds like the Human League, but these kids hadn't heard the Human League. So they don't. So I think it kind of, for some people, for some younger people, it represented something really new and exciting. But in actuality, I feel it's a record I'm very proud of, but I definitely see where it's derived from.
Yeah, there was a lot of that that was starting to happen. I think a lot of indie electronica stuff. There was like The Blow, which I think was Northwest, what was that girl that I can't remember her name. It was kind of like a Harmar thing where she just would like Tracing the Plastics.
Oh yeah, sure, yeah,
yeah.
Sure.
And so there was a feeling that like there was people starting to kind of do that, but no one had, I think, the pop sensibilities as much as like when you guys came together. I think that's probably what. And then it was also right when Sub Pop's like second heyday started happening as well, right?
Yeah, they had a pretty dark period in the late 90s where I think it seemed like they kind of decided they could do anything and then kind of realized that they really couldn't do anything, like that maybe country music was not not what was going to really work for them. And you know, I think between the Pulse Service record and the Shins Introverted World and a couple other albums, it seemed like Hot Heat too. I feel like they kind of,
that's right, that was that the kind of electro clash kind of stuff,
they had a bunch of stuff that kind of sold really well at a time, which I mean I don't know the finances of the label at that point, but it certainly seemed like they were kind of living off of, you know, Nirvana.
Yeah. That Hot Hot Heat really flamed out, huh? I didn't mean to make a pun about it, but they really, like, they were going to be huge.
The next big band.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Those guys were so good live.
Yeah.
They were just unbelievable.
I saw them in The Faint in, like, summer of 99 or 2000 at Scolari's office in San Diego, and it was just one of the funnest shows I'd ever been to in my life.
I saw them open for some friends of mine who will remain nameless because I don't want to embarrass them, and they were like the middle support band, and they just blew them off the stage.
Was it the Beatles?
Yes, it was. It was Wings. Actually.
It was Wings. It was Wings.
But
it was The Doors.
But they were phenomenal. I don't quite know what happened there.
And Sub Pop started a thing around that time called the Woody. Was that? Am I getting that right?
They were giving out. We have one. I think they had determined that selling 100,000 records was ostensibly like indie rock platinum.
Yeah.
But to give out a platinum record, you couldn't legally give out a platinum
now
record.
Now it's actually platinum.
Yeah, exactly. They should be like 10,000 records. Yeah. But no, they made wood records that were like 100,000 was wood.
Yeah.
And they made these wood, which I have in my.
Yeah, they have them like up in the hallways there. But then they actually ended up getting, you know, actual platinum records, I think.
Yeah, I think the Fleet Foxes record went gold, at least the first one did, maybe the second one.
That's crazy.
Now I can't get Human League out of my head. Like, I'm trying to think of a band that basically uses bass as like a lead. Like all those songs were just all like bass, kind of bass driven in a way. But I don't know, does anyone do that?
I feel like I might have just assassinated myself with, like, maybe I'm gonna get like a Pharrell style like lawsuit, kind of like somebody's gonna serve me outside of SIR here.
So let's talk about that for a sec, because
represent Human League?
You know what when I was reading about the article, and if I'm getting this wrong, I apologize, but it's just from my my typical citizen of the internet, I read some stuff about it without deep diving into the case. So I apologize.
As is the way of the internet.
I apologize for my – I call it the apocryphrips, which is just basically – it's all apocrypha at this point. It's just people going, I'm commenting like I know exactly what happened. Did you read the – I read a headline or a guy told me, but I didn't actually do
it's an argument at a bar.
It's all arguments at a bar, but like you're in court. it's obvious that the songs are very similar, but I thought that even when they brought in the lead sheets, they were like, well, they're not identical, but tonally it's the same. And then that's where it's sort of dangerous to music, is that if you can sue someone on the base of tonal similarity,
then we are getting a letter from Bill to Spill.
Everyone
for our first record.
Everyone's
going to
get
happen.
Fucking sued always, because everything is somewhat derivative of something else, because that's just the way human beings are.
Yeah, you know, I kind of follow that in a similar peripheral fashion, and it seems a little bit scary that a legal precedent has been set. That things can be similar, and that's enough to kind of demand a writing credit or publishing on a song. And it'll be interesting to see how that kind of plays out over the years to come, whether or not that is a strong enough precedent for other people to sue for having their copyrights infringed.
Yeah,
whatever,
can't but. Tom Petty sue? What's that guy?
Like Sam Smith.
Yeah, Sam.
Well,
Smith.
I think they settled that.
Oh, they
that
did.
Was settled. Yeah, I think that I read like a statement from Tom Petty, and he kind of said something along the lines of like, "Yeah, you know, I mean, I'm just." He was very above board about the whole thing. It's like, I'm glad we could share this song together or something like that. Or something that was like, I think he might have been the one who got the lawyers on the phone. I don't know.
Yeah.
But he kind of acted, he had a very kind of like,
well, there was the Lady Gaga song that was basically Vogue, right?
Yeah.
I wonder if Madonna, did Madonna go after her for that? I mean, I feel like there's so many cases.
Well, I suppose the question should be, who should be shaking in their boots right now, worried about, you know, being served papers for two songs sounding
I guess
too similar.
I guess everybody in a way, because there's only so many chords. So there's only so many ways to
the Ramones are going to sue every funk band ever.
It's going to be a trickle down. Yeah, and exactly. Someone's going to sue them. Yeah. And then it's going to go all the way back.
Marky is the one?
Yeah.
The last one? Yeah. He's just going to start showing up to places like, and then, hey, Tom, Mark Hoppus.
And then going back, black people are going to sue all of rock and roll for stealing everything. So, I mean, it is kind of a difficult, it's just sort of a strange situation now that you can't just, I mean, because, you know, it happens with jokes sometimes where sometimes you can't remember if you thought of something or if it's reminding you of something that's a memory. And those areas where you have to call people and go, have you heard this before? Does the same thing happen for you?
With songs?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I would like to hope that by the time we are recording a song for an album, that I have played a particular composition for enough people, including like my bandmates, a record producer, somebody at the record label, a lawyer, and like it's gotten through all of those hoops, and nobody said like, hey, this really kind of sounds exactly like U2's Desire or whatever it might be. You know, I mean, it's like. You know what I mean? Like, it's like it's got you would hope that at some point somebody would pull the ripcord on it if it was that similar.
No, but our song is called Designer, and it's all about interior
designer.
Design. Oh, designer.
Dunk, dunk, ding, dunk, ding.
Also, I am not Irish, so that doesn't really...
I mean, that exonerates you right there.
I think the Death Cab sound is so specific. I mean, like, you from the very first album I heard of yours, like, oh, okay, well, this guy knows his, like, this is your voice, like, you know what your voice is. I mean, your point of view, and it didn't seem like, well, you know, this, you know, some bands like flounder for like an album or two and then they find it, but it sounds like, it feels like right away you kind of had this very strong identity.
Yeah, even though you said, like, you know, you were ripping off Built to Spill in the beginning, like, I still like wouldn't have thought that, and I was listening. I heard Belt to Spill, then I heard you guys, and I would have never been like,
we'll make sure and say that in our deposition.
Yeah, would you please?
Heard that.
Yeah.
Now it's obvious.
This is going to be in the podcast, right? This is going to be for everybody.
But I think it's also a thing when you listen to that type of music, you can understand the, you know, if I could show someone like a bunch of different, like, you know, they won't know the difference between NOFX and the Dickies and Blink 182. You know, some people just don't have an ear for a certain type of sound. But like, it's like having listened to all that stuff a lot, you know, like I would have never guessed that.
I think over time, I still to this day have a hard time believing or hearing what a Death Cab sound is, if there is such a thing, because I still hear all the influences that I have as clearly as I stated earlier going into the music. You know, I mean, I'm primarily a fan of music, and you know, so there have been a couple occasions when somebody I know has come up to me and been like, man, have you heard this young band? They sound exactly like you guys. I mean, seriously, like, you really need to like check this out. Like, you might like, you, like, I don't know, you may want to sue these guys, like that kind of thing. And I would listen to it, not with, you know, a lawsuit in mind, but just like, I want to hear what this person hears in my music that they think is so signature that this band is, you know, allegedly ripping us off. And I can never hear it.
What was the band? Do you remember any of the,
Thankfully, I there's one, but I think it's probably best to kind of,
Sure.
To not talk about, on this podcast, but you know,
is it Insane Clown Posse?
Yes, yes,
it's
it is.
ICP,
very similar.
No, but it's a couple, you know, younger bands. But I just don't. I mean, because I still, you know, we've
found to happen.
Well, yeah, and to the Build to Spill thing, you know, we've played shows at Build to Spill. We're going to do some shows in the summer. Like, we're friendly with those guys, and like, And I remember, like, we're playing on stage, and, like, Doug and a couple of the other dudes are watching us, and I'm just like, we're playing the song that has, like, some very, like, Martian, you know, Northwest kind of guitar lines in it. And I just was thinking, like, is this guy listening to us just being like, motherfucker?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's like there's those moments where I get really self-conscious about it. So if after 17 years of doing this band, I'm still self-conscious about my own influences, I'm in no position to go after some young band and be like, hey man, it's fucked up, you guys, because it has to come from somewhere.
Well,
you know?
I also think that you know, one of two things would happen. If they don't develop their own voice, then they're not going to stick around. And if they are too similar to you, then at a certain level, people aren't going to stand for it, and then it's going to fall. You know what I mean? Like, they will.
I think they
will be forced. You know, everyone sort of starts off heavily with their heavy influences, but then the more you do it, the more you kind of find your own thing. And I think eventually they would shed. And like have their own interpretation of that thing.
You certainly hope so. I mean, I'd like to hope that we have done that to in a certain extent, given the bands that we were really influenced by. Yeah. But you know, it's been a long time. I've been doing this for a while now.
And you know, and like I said before, like that'll happen. And some like I'll always defend. There was a band I really got into, Hockey Night. It was one of the last Lookout Records bands, but like they sounded exactly like Pavement, just like the guy, just you know, drawl, just like Malcolmus, all that stuff. But I was like, well, Pavement's not putting out any records, and these guys sound like Pavement. I just kind of was like, oh. And then, like, same thing with, like, you know, when Troubled Hubble came around, I was like, well, Dismemberment Plan's not around anymore. Might as well listen to these guys.
Well, what's interesting for me now is that I'm of an age that I now remember that musical styles that were popular when I was a teenager are now coming back around.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are, like, a band that sounds like, maybe exactly like the Jesus and Mary Chain. And people are like, these guys are unbelievable.
Yeah.
These guys, I've never heard anything like this before. And it's like, yeah, that sounds like the Jesus and Mary Chain. And that's fine for them. I'm not, you know, I'm not going to like go around slagging these guys because they sound like Jesus and Mary Chain. But I don't need a record by a band that sounds like the Jesus and Mary Chain because I have all those Jesus and Mary Chain records. I don't need a copy of that band. I'll just listen to the original band.
Yeah. You have enough of that.
I think I got enough.
Yeah. Do you ever feel constrained by the thing that you've created in the sense that if you have an idea to do something that's a little left to center and you're like, well, but it's not really what I would categorize as a death cab thing.
Do
so
you
I
want to make a ska song?
I'm really not that creative. I don't remember having an urge that was to make something or do something so, like, you know, you like joke about doing a ska song, but it's like anything of that, like that far outside of what we do would just be laughable. So I don't see, I mean, unless I don't know what type of music I would all of a sudden feel so strongly about that I was like, no, this is the, you know, Peruvian throat singing record by Death Cab for Cutie, and this is important music, and you need to respect it the same way you respect everything else, because this is like my new direction, and I demand that you enjoy it.
Well, you know, your solo album didn't veer too far away from the Death Cab sound, and there was some stuff like the opening track, you know, with all the different layers of vocals. Mm-hmm. And when I heard you were putting out a solo album, I wasn't sure if it was going to be like Doug March's solo album, which was just, you know, all slide guitar and acoustic stuff. Were those songs that like you didn't want to bring to the rest of the band, or did you feel better just like I want to wildflowers this?
I mean, there were like three or four tunes that just kind of were that we didn't seem like they were appropriate for the record we were making at the time, and then a number of songs that I'd been kind of holding on to that, you know, weren't kind of in keeping with the tone of the records we had made before. So I'd kind of been holding on to these songs for a long time, and I was like, you know, I'm just going to record these and put them out. And the record's a super mixed bag, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, I think there's some really strong things on it, but at the same time, it's also like, yeah, it wasn't intended to be like a
full record.
It wasn't like, intended to be like a stepping out in front.
Yeah.
Here I am. This is my big, you know, moment to step out as a solo artist.
Yeah.
It was just like, yeah, I got a bunch of songs. I write a lot of songs, and, you know, I felt these were some of the better ones that didn't fit on Death Cab Records and wanted to just put it together. So.
Oh, cool.
There's a band that comes up a lot on my shuffle, and it's a band that I loved from the late 80s, early 90s, and it feels like they just disappeared. And if they didn't, I apologize. But did you guys like the Smithereens at all?
Oh, my God. Yeah. I love the Smithereens.
I fucking love the Smithereens. Yeah. And every time, like, Blood and Roses or I'll do – like, anytime one of their songs come, I'm like, why didn't this – why were they – this one, like every song was really cool and they seemed like a cool band.
Yeah. I mean, I do you watch, Homeland?
Homeland is not something I've watched yet. Are they on Homeland?
No, the reference.
Are they a terror cell?
The reference I was going to make was
Smithereens! Oh my God, it makes sense now!
Then my joke about how the singer of the Smithereens looks like a guy on Homeland is just not going to that's not going to work. I'm going to just walk away from that one right now.
But I remember.
Anyway, and we'll laugh.
I don't even know the guy's name, so it's really.
It's Ted Smithereen.
He named the band. Jimmy Smithereen.
Smithereens.
No, that band is phenomenal. I'm not sure what they're doing these days, but that's not because they're probably doing something. I'm just kind of.
Hanging out with the House Martins.
That's another one.
Prefab Sprout.
I kind of feel like something that. I mean, I don't know if we're going to be able to I doubt we will be able to convince you to do this, but I feel like it'd be funny if you just played a little bit of All Star by Smash Mouth.
Hey, now, you're an All Star. Get your game on. Get paid.
Oh,
get
probably. Paid.
Yeah,
go play.
Go play.
Yeah.
Hey, now, you're an All Star. Get your hat on.
I have to say, speaking of Smash Mouth, I really legitimately love that first single, Walking on the Sun. That is a fucking great song. The production of that song is like nobody was kind of mining that that palette at that time. This really kind of like
I remember when
it's
that
such
song,
a great song.
I remember when that I was working at K-Rock and I was walking by I feel like I was walking by Kevin Weatherly's office and he goes, "Hey, come in here for a sec. What do you think of this song?" And it was Smash Mouth, Walking on the Sun. And I was like, this is fucking great. Because to me, speaking of like potential lawsuits, it sounds almost identical to the Zombies.
Yeah, it's very zombie. Zombies.
She's not there.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's a song called She's Not There, and it's almost identical. Da-na-da. And so I loved, you know, I hadn't really heard like someone pulling the 60s into what was at the time alternative rock. Yeah. Even though they got pretty mainstream. And I know we shit on Smash Mouth a lot just for fun.
It's just fun.
It's more because
they got that Shrek money. They don't give a shit.
It's more because of the name Smash Mouth is fun. Yeah. But I actually do really like that song.
I love that song. And I mean, when that song was on the radio, I didn't know what those guys looked like. I didn't know. I had no. The image. No. That's not what I meant. That's not what I meant. It's like I guess the song was so kind of it was so reminiscent of like the Zombies and that period of kind of Baroque-y kind of pop stuff, the organ and everything that I was imagining them as looking, you know, like a mod group.
Right.
You know? No, so it was a shock to see these dudes from the OC who
like surfer bouncers.
Yeah. Who don't. But I thought that was so fucking cool. I was like, I love the fact that I had an image in my mind of what these guys look like and they don't look like that at all. And like, I actually really like when those juxtapositions, in all seriousness, when those juxtapositions happen where it's like, yeah, I just didn't see this music coming out of these guys. I was kind of great.
And I met them at a K-Rock concert once. They were really nice.
Sure.
They were like super nice dudes.
Good guys.
Yeah. You're not a fan.
Tale as old as time, Chris.
Song as old as rhyme.
Yeah.
Beauty and the Beast. So how many dates is the tour going to take you on?
God, I don't know. Hundreds.
Oh, man.
Not hundreds. Dozens.
Do you like that?
I actually kind of do. Yeah. I mean, we've scaled it back considerably from when we were from the transatlanticism/plans days, like 2003 through 2006, where it was like that was the moment and we just really felt like we had to jump on every opportunity and be on the road all the time. And I'm glad we did it because it's allowed us a little more freedom now to not have to do it with that level of frequency. But, you know, I think we've kind of got it to a place now where, you know, we'll go on the road for 3 weeks, we'll come home for a couple weeks, go back out. You know, a couple of the guys, one of the guys has two kids, you know, another one of our guys has a kid on the way. So it's like, you know, it's trying to integrate a rock and roll band into middle age is a challenge that, you know, I feel like we're doing a pretty good job of right now.
Yeah. I mean, it's, I don't sustaining, like even as a doing stand-up, I couldn't go out for just like 7 months and just be gone.
Well, because you'd be by yourself the whole time. That's the difference. I mean, in a band, there's the four, now the five of us, there's, you know, road crew, you know, there are, you know, and people around us all the time. So it's just, it's like a strange family that we have now, that when we go out on the road, you know, days off, everybody, people are, you know, pairing off in groups and going to dinner, and we're kind of getting together and getting into adventures, and it's fun. It's, yeah, such, it's a really fun way to live.
What I should start doing is just touring with a full band set up, and then have people set up all the music equipment, but never play a song.
No.
Have them break it down, get back on the
bus.
Sounds
like a good use of resources. And
I think it'd be really good. Yeah. Yeah, it'd be worth it to lose money every time I go out on the road.
And everyone's just going to be like, just not laughing as much. They're like, when's he going to, why is there?
I'll just never refer to it.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I'm lucky now, though, because I have a girlfriend who is super cool, and she will come on the road with me whenever she can. So it's easy. It's better than, you know, I mean, the
it's
long,
lonely.
The long. It is really lonely. Yeah. It's really, really lonely.
And my girlfriend is, she toured with bands for years, and now is kind of taking a little bit of a hiatus on the road. At least, you know, working on the road. So it allows her to come out with us, which is great because she also kind of gets the environment of what we're doing, and that, you know, there have been times where people have come out on the road with me or with, you know, other members of my band, and there's this kind of, you know, false sense that this is like some kind of roving party, or that like, hey, we're in Paris, let's spend 7 hours walking around, looking at, go to the Louvre and stuff. It's like, man, I gotta play tonight. I gotta talk to like five journalists. Like, I gotta take a nap right now. This is my work is happening at 9 p.m. I just cannot spend the whole day being a tourist. And that is a bummer a lot of the time, because you get to go to these great places, but you don't actually get to see anything.
You've seen a lot of great hotels from the inside.
Well, I've seen a lot of great venues. I've been inside a venue or parked outside of a venue for hours, and it's, you know, it's not something one can really complain about, but it certainly is not the experience that I think a lot of people think that we are having. And it's nice to be with somebody who totally gets it and understands, like, you gotta work tonight. It's not, this isn't a vacation for you. This is work. This is, you know, it's a real job.
Do you still have friends in bands that are around from when you guys started, and you guys are all just still, you know, in vans and stuff like that? Like, are any of those bands you started with still around?
Yeah. I mean, not a lot of the bands, but a lot of the musicians. Yeah, I mean, Dave Bazan is a really good friend of ours, and he was in a band called Pay to the Lion back in the day. And you know, there, I have friends, you know, like him that have been doing this for roughly the same period of time. And it's been interesting to kind of be able to share, not necessarily the stories from back in the day, but just kind of how we're moving forward as musicians in this kind of new climate. And some of us are more successful than others, but, you know, it's been really interesting to see kind of how a lot of my friends have navigated the changing kind of,
it is really
tides.
Neat to follow bands that way, musicians that way. Like, the guy Jonah from Jonah's One Line Drawing, like just started just like releasing all these kind of funny albums. And it was just really neat to see like the different, and, you know, the guy, Mark Trombino, who was in Drive Like Jehu and went on to produce a bunch of Jimmy Ward records. Now he has a donut shop in
Highland
Park.
He really?
Yeah. It's called Donut Friend, and it's all just like punk rock puns, for the names of donuts.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah,
I gotta be honest. Awesome. You say a lot of people in bands, and I'm like, those aren't real bands and people. You're just mashing words together.
Yeah. There's a lot of,
I'm lost a lot of the time when I'm hearing you talk about music in a very casual way. Like, I don't know what any of those are.
It's weird. People will make fun of me. Like, they're like, it's like, we get it. You know, obscure bands. I was like, yeah, but we're like, for me and my friends, those are some of the biggest bands we know.
Yeah.
It's
I totally relate to that. These bands that you saw with 100 other people changed your life. And, you know, I think it's good to have that perspective that, like, look, this changed my life, but I don't expect it to have the same effect on you. And I learned that the hard way, trying to play some bands that were really important to me to, at the time, my ex-wife, who like did not care about Slint. You know what I mean? There's just a thing where you're just like, yeah, you know, it's, and I realize in the moment, it's like, oh yeah, this, so much of understanding, not necessarily Slint, but just a lot of the music that I, was really important to me growing up is contextual.
Yeah.
And it doesn't make the music any less important to me, but it's like you play somebody, the Beatles, who's never heard the Beatles, which is unbelievable to me. But let's say you could find somebody who heard the Beatles, you play it for them, you're like, yeah, oh man, it's kind of, yeah, the Beatles. This is kind of interesting. Yeah. There's a reason that millions and millions of people have gotten into this. There's something universal about it. But, you know, Slint is a very strange band that I happen to love very much.
Yes.
But not the kind of band that somebody who has no context for it is most likely going to be like, wow, this is fantastic.
Do you think a significant other has to have the same, like, do you think you have to have at least somewhat similar musical tastes?
I think you do when you're 25.
Okay.
I think when you're 25, your music and movies and books are the most important things to you. At least they were to me.
Yeah.
And I think as you get older, you realize, like, look, this is my stuff. As long as that person isn't giving you grief for liking the things you like, as long as there's a live and let live kind of dynamic to the relationship, and that you know, because you care about that person, you express interest in the things that they like, sometimes out of obligation, but a lot of times I feel like when you open yourself up to something that is outside of your worldview, something that somebody likes, and you go like, yeah, I understand why you dig this. That's pretty cool. I never would have found out about this if you had not turn me on to it.
Yeah, exactly. Know? Like, for example, like me and Dee, we have very different tastes. Like, she really likes the Queers, and I like Screeching Weasel. That's a really specific joke.
I saw Spotted Dick open for the Lollipops at Krabby's Chicken Shack.
There was a band called the Lollipops.
God damn it.
Yeah. But going back to what you're saying about, like, the idea, like, Slint means a lot to you. Like, Built to Spill means a lot to you. And to us, those are huge bands. Those are, like, monolith bands that, like, you know, were life-changing. And I always think about that a lot with when it comes to being a creative person in any field, where it's just like, does everybody have to know who you are? No, but... Like, does the idea that you maybe, like, you know, inspired somebody to do something on their own, does that make a bigger difference? Yeah, it's like, you know, like, Ian MacKaye is still, like, a very huge influence in my life, even though I don't really make music or anything like that. It's just like, but, like, the idea that, you know, he made a big deal to me doesn't, like, and the fact that mostly everybody will never know who he is doesn't take anything
away from
that.
Would it bother you if they did?
No, not at all. I think everyone should know who he is. But, like, it's like, I don't think it takes anything away. And I think it just...
Well, it shouldn't take anything away.
Yeah.
Because, and if it does, you know, I believe that you have an unhealthy relationship to a band or an artist or a novelist or whatever it might be if you need the validation of your peers for liking this thing.
It's also very selfish to be like, no one else, that's mine. It's like, it's not just yours. It can be a lot of people's, and you should want to share it with people.
But that's something that I'm sure everybody's experienced when either as a fan of something or... You know, in being in a place where it's like, yeah, you know, I used to come see you guys when there were like 50 people now, and then 50 people there. Now there's 5,000, and it's like I was there first, just so you know. It's like,
yeah, just so you know.
Good for you. Were you the first person to ever hear our band? Oh, you weren't. Okay, well then, there's people that were there before you. Are they bigger fans than you are? I just don't buy this whole idea that there's a right way or a wrong way to get turned on to something, or that there's, you know, if you were into a band, let's say earlier than somebody else, that somehow you have like you have claim on that band as a bigger fan than the person who got into them last year. I just think it's kind of a childish way to look at
it. It can be intimidating sometimes. I mean, you know, I always call it the guided by voices conundrum, where it's like you hear a song, you're like, wow, these guys are great. And then you go to the record store and they have two rows of albums. You go, they've clearly been around longer than I assumed. I'm just going to back away.
I can't ever listen to guided by voices again.
What?
Really?
I know we have to let Ben go in a sec, but yeah, it's a weird story. It's a very weird story. But after, I don't know if I've ever told it, but after I did this musical play called Rock of Ages, and then the music director recommended me for something a couple years later that Steven Soderbergh, I think, was going to do a musical version of the story of Cleopatra with the soundtrack of All Guided by Voices.
What the
That's
fuck
insane.
Up? That's not
and,
real.
And Hugh Jackman was going to be in it, and Catherine Zeta-Jones was going to play Cleopatra.
Are you making this up right
not
now?
Not making this
Holy
up.
Holy shit.
And so... They said, we need someone to go in and sing the scratch vocals so they can start laying out the – and so they recommended me for it. And so at the time, I was really starting to work a lot, and so I was very busy, and I barely listened. And I was familiar with – I mean, I know the band, but not like – I couldn't just start singing. You think you know a band until someone's like, sing every note, and you're like, God, oh, shit, yeah, I don't really know. And so I went in sort of not very rehearsed. And it was a fucking disaster.
Oh, fuck.
And they were recording on like reel to reel. And I couldn't get the songs. And it was the first time that I wrote a whole article about it on Nerdist too, about like learn when to say no to things. Like learn when it is not advantageous to you to take on another project. And because I couldn't put all the work on it It was one of the valuable learning experiences ever. And I didn't take any money for it. And the people who did the sessions were – I could see them like just like very angry and frustrated on the other side of the glass. And I was embarrassed. And it was one of the biggest kind of creative disasters that I've ever had. So I guess I'm lucky that that's happened. But
that's crazy.
But – and then I called to apologize to my music director friend. And she was like, oh, it doesn't matter. They scrapped the project anyway. So like there was a period of time where I'm pretty sure – yeah, Soderbergh was going to do the Story of Cleopatra with all Guided by Voices songs. And they were going to basically adapt them to
I mean,
to be
that,
the soundtrack.
That scenario seems like something – if you had like a bunch of bands, stories, and directors and had them in like a lotto jumbler and just pulled out.
See, Guided by Voices.
Guided by Voices.
Hugh Jackman. Steven Soderbergh.
And just like – and there's like, let's make that. That sounds like how that project came
out. And so because of that – and I have all the Guided by Voices songs, and whenever they come up on Shuffle, I quickly – I have not listened to Guided by Voices since that happened in 2009.
Damn.
Because I was so – 2008. So I was so traumatized by how much I fucked that up.
Oh, my God. That's – I mean, I love Guided by Voices so much.
Yeah.
Someday maybe I'll be able to go back.
Wow. That's just – I'm still – that's blowing my mind. I can't believe that's a real
thing. Maybe they'll revive it now.
I'm just only going to think of like ways Cleopatra could sing a, like Guided by Voices songs now.
And I suppose this is post American Idiot, right?
Right.
So this is like – because I remember around that time – all of these crazy ass ideas for musicals kind of being floated around in the universe. And a couple of people got in touch with me about like, hey, if you ever want to write a musical, it's like, that sounds like the worst thing. That sounds like the last thing I'd want
to
do.
I don't need to tell the audience the story that makes these songs make sense. Like they should just make sense to people.
A dude from Belle and Sebastian made a musical. But it was like it was a movie, but it was great. It was good.
I feel like one of the things I love about being a songwriter and a musician is that like you write the thing, you go in the studio, you make it, you record it, and like you really don't have to answer to anybody else. So why would you invite? Why would you invite like
everything under a microscope?
Why would you invite producers into that? Like I mean, like musical producers and directors and actors. Yeah. Why would you fuck that up by inviting all these insane people into it? Like just very keep it pure, man.
It also kind of ruins it. Like it forces you to give the songs subtext, where like to give someone a reason to break into that song is so on the nose.
Well, I'll tell you.
Yeah, exactly.
But I do think it'd be fun to kind of write this sub, like he sees me, who knows why, what's going on, like that kind of the thoughts of the character in the song.
That'd be great.
So maybe let's write the next Death Cab record that way.
Do it as a musical.
Yes, yeah. and then sell that, and then it's like just walk away from it.
So before we let you go, when we came in, and please forgive me for asking this, but you said it's nice to see you again. Where did we meet before?
I think we met at the late show a very, very long time ago.
Oh,
it was like a very long, but it was one of those like, hey.
Yes, hey, yes, hey. Yes, yes.
I was like, I was this far away, I was 5 feet away from you. I was like, hey.
Because your ex was on.
Yeah, she was on the show. You
that's
guys
right.
I was like, hey, how's it going?
That's right. I remember. That's exactly what we do talking. Okay, yes.
But it's also one of those things where like, I feel like when you walked in, I put you in that unfortunate position that I think we've all been in at certain times where somebody, you're like, hey, nice to meet you. And you're like, yeah, we've met before.
Yeah.
And it makes you like, and it's like, that's why you have to take on like do the politician move of like, good to see you.
Yeah.
Good to see you.
Yeah. Good to see you.
Good to see you. Not again. Not again.
And then you're just hoping someone doesn't go, do you remember the first? Yeah. But now that you've said that, I completely remember that. You were in the dressing room in the hallway. And yes, I remember.
But also as somebody who meets a lot of people and you meet a lot of people, it's understandable that sometimes in the course of like a week of meeting people and like having like very, you know, like, hey, how's it going? Kind of interaction.
Yeah.
Like I would never take it personally that you don't remember
that. I should totally remember that because I remember you had your dick out and you were smearing pudding all over your face.
Yeah.
And I was I will never forget this. But
I was like, Chris.
Okay, that's all coming
remember
back
that?
Now.
Pudding on his face?
Pudding on his face. Yeah. He was doing it. It was so good to actually sit down and chat with you.
Yeah, totally. This was a lot of fun.
Just said hi. So please come back when you're done with the tour.
I'll do that for sure.
And check in and thank you to and if you want to play a few lines from All Star, you're more than welcome to do that, but no pressure.
Go for it.
All right, enjoy your burrito, everyone. Oh, you're going to play a song now. Now I'm going to get all when it becomes eclectic.
Right.
So, Ben, what song are you going to play for the listeners now?
I'm going to play a song from our new record, and it is called Black Sun.
The new record is out now. And is it kintsugi,
which is the art when something cracks, to put precious metals in it so you highlight the flaws in something and not try to make it perfect.
That is correct.
Thank you. It's Japanese.
Yeah, I knew that too.
You didn't know that.
Yeah, you didn't just give me
because that's not a band name, you dick.
Hey,
what?
Here's Ben Gibbon of Death Camp for Cutie. Here on When It Becomes Erectic.
I don't know.
Oh, a dick joke.
What? That doesn't mean a dick joke. It could be like I'm erecting a building.
Yeah, but
that's shaped like
you.
A dick.
It's you, so it's...
Shut up.
Okay.
Get out.
All right.
Okay, so are you guys rolling? I can just kind of dive into this? Okay. God, this feels really fucking weird. Did you stand behind me? Can you get on the riser? There is whiskey in the water, and there is death upon the vine. There is fear in the eyes of your father, and there is yours, and there is mine. There is a desert veiled in pavement, and there's a city of seven hills. Now our debris flows to the ocean. To meet again, I hope it will. How could something so fair be so cruel? When this black sun revolves around you, there is an answer and a question. There is hope within despair. And there is beauty in a failure. And there are depths beyond compare. There is a role of a lifetime. And there's a song yet to be sung. And there's a dumpster in the driveway of all the plans that came undone. How could something so fair be so cruel when this black sun revolve around you? How could something so fair be so cruel when this black sun revolve around? There is whiskey in the water, and there is death upon the vine. And there is grace within forgiveness, but it's so hard for me to find. How could something so fair be so cruel when this
black sun revolve around you. How could something so fair be so cruel when this black sun revolved around you?
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.